The exciting prospect about being in the underwriting management discipline in cybersecurity insurance is that if you've been doing this for a number of years, or even just started yesterday, there's always something new to contemplate, such that you have to examine, how are you supporting the business? How are you supporting your underwriters? How are you supporting data science and actuary to put forth not only products that our clients want to buy, but also service their needs? And with the evolution of now very meaningful data sets coming in, and we're able to examine, what does good risk selection look like? How do we lean into data science tools to extract meaningful insights?
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cyber Insurance Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Hess. Stay tuned.
Good morning and good afternoon, Megan. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
That's great. Great having you. So I like to kick off with just some questions about yourself. Just get to know you a little better, as well as your team and your company. So kind of maybe just lead off with an introduction.
Sure. I am Megan Hannes, U.S. Head of Underwriting Management for Beazley. What that means in short is we look after all things underwriting infrastructure. We also look at guideline ethos. We partner with data science, with actuary, to ensure that we instill what informs good risk selection into meaningful application and tools for our underwriting community, and obviously ensure that we are doing it all within the confines of admitted compliance when necessary.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for that. I think you kind of mentioned geographies, but if there's any more you want to add on that.
Yeah, I focus on all things US. So it is our goal each and every day to ensure that our underwriters are empowered with, again, those trading tools, particularly applications and policy forms that are products that they are proud to distribute into our broker community.
Cool. I also like to ask just a few more questions about your company. Just in terms of size and sector of clients, like, who do you really focus on?
At Beazley, we can service the largest insured to down to a small mom and pop shop. So we truly do focus on each type of insured anywhere in value chain, whether that be, again, a very small revenue or up through the largest Fortune 5s.
Okay, cool. And the last sort of background question I like to ask is, what would you say your company's strength is in cyber?
One of my favorite things about Beazley is that we are a full service model. And what do I mean by that? I mean that we are with our insureds every step of the way, whether that be pre or post breach response. And we are certainly there for them in their time of need. We are the only market that has a full service cyber services department, such that they don't necessarily need to incite a claim to understand if there's something going on in their environment. They can contact our cyber services department and they will ensure that they get to the right folks if they've had a claim, or our cyber services team can help them themselves. We also enlisted a cyber@beazley.com helpline for our customers to ensure that they understand what their risk profile looks like, and if they want to also ensure that they optimize that risk profile once they've seen some of our tools and tips to help them do that.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for all that background info. I think a lot of the listeners enjoyed getting the bigger picture of the companies our guests are from. So I guess to kick off kind of the thought leadership questions, I thought we'd talk about the application process. You know, what kind of issues are you seeing? You know, what do you think is important in the application process, and what should we be doing?
So The application has come a long way since the cyber market inception. It's seen a lot of variations. It's been lengthened. It's been shortened. It's been lengthened again once we hit our ransomware epidemic in 2020. And now we're really getting into that sweet spot of what informs good risk selection, because we have more meaningful claims data and also that really juicy inflation data that our actuaries know and love. But what does it all mean? It means that we are primed to continue to examine the application questions we ask and the application questions that may no longer be serving us. And for me, an application question that we could really be thinking about is record count, right? So record count had its place in the early days of data breach. It was a direct link to understand severity from a response perspective. But more recent data has shown that record count may not be as statistically relevant in today's market, just given the evolution of the market. And I know this will be a big win for our cyber services team, but one of the points of consideration that we're examining and go forward is looking at number of endpoints, as opposed to record count, as a more specified way to understand not only that frequency and severity risk, but also how do we optimize our processes to help ensure that we are servicing our customers for the future based on their needs.
Yeah, I think endpoint makes a lot of sense, and it's probably a lot easier to understand. I think record count is sure, if you're talking about a structured database, you probably know what your record count is. But you look at the actual incidents we see, it's usually somebody stealing a big chunk of data, and we have to figure out what data is there, right?
Right.
So it's in your email or on your system or whatever. It's all this unstructured data that's, you know, wherever it is, rather than being like, oh yeah, we have an SAP system with X numbers of records. So it makes sense that going to endpoints makes more sense. I guess just in terms of misconceptions, maybe just from the application process, like you get these kind of responses to these applications. What are maybe some common misconceptions that you've seen out there?
Yeah, one of the most common, I won't call it a misconception, but maybe rather an assumption, is such that application answers equals loss ratio outcomes, right? And that's the majority of the picture, but it's not the entire picture, such that application questions are a response, an individual insured's response to a selected set of questions that have been determined to inform good risk selection. But then that application response needs to be taken away and understood where it sits in context with that individual portfolio management in terms of good, better, best, or underperforming in that case. So it's not as simple as let's look at these application responses, and that would assume that if favorable responses equal profitability, it's something that needs to be spun up into portfolio management, claims data brought in, actuarial data brought in, and then you get a sense of the whole picture of how that application response, not only in individual questions, but the collection of those individual responses by that one insured, and how those individual responses bubble up to successful portfolio management.
Okay. Kind of earlier in what we were talking about, you're mentioning sort of the improved claims data, you know, the better understanding we have now of the actual risk. Just what are your thoughts in general on the maturation of cyber insurers over the past few years, and where do you see it going?
We entered into year of accounts, you know, latter 2020, 2021, 2022, all coming from a similar place where the cyber liability pricing had largely been based on historical assumptions. Usually, not always, but usually on a market basis from professional lines, and those inflation assumptions baked into that pricing was also something that had been kept relatively stagnant, right? So it didn't have much context behind it other than the inflation that we had seen again in professional lines. So when you take a year like late 2019, 2020, 2021, that really gives you a juicy set of actuarial data of which to pull new insights and assumptions steeped in a very meaningful set of data, not only from a frequency and severity perspective, but then obviously just from a voluminous perspective, right? Mm-hmm. Just based on the number of actual claims we saw outside of the frequency and severity of those claims. So it just really gave us a new body of data to work with going forward into the next coming of age of mm-hmm. cyber liability insurance.
Okay, so I think this kind of leads off that then. So what about your thoughts on technical pricing and where it's been and where it's going?
So technical pricing for me is all about not only understand where individual risks sit in space, but what inputs contribute to the technical pricing of that risk. Because we now have better insights into how frequency and severity behaves within a reasonable set of data assumptions, because we saw so much again, increased frequency and severity in year of accounts 2020, 2021, it just gives us heightened confidence in that data to make more informed decisions steeped in claims. Right. So the running joke, and if you know, if anyone attended a conference, the odds are you probably heard this, but the running joke in what 2016, 17, 18 was really, we're going to have claims to be relevant.
Yeah.
Well, we got our wish, right?
Lots of claims.
Not only did we get our wish granted, but we also got a lot of data as a result. And that data spins into more sound actuarial assumptions that we can take forward and continue to evaluate our pricing models.
Okay. what do you kind of see then, I guess, as some of the top challenges that you're facing going forward? And what is it? Maybe give me some examples as well.
Some of the top challenges we face to really switch gears would be, just that normalization of cybersecurity importance, mm-hmm. right? So not that it's an indifference, but more just a exhaustion of cybersecurity importance, right? So it's a constant game of cat and mouse to ensure that you're one step ahead of the threat actors, to ensure your systems are hardened, right? But one of the challenges we face is such that the normalization of the importance of cybersecurity insurance can also impact things like application length, right? Mm-hmm. So as an insurer, you always want to be very mindful that you're collecting meaningful points to inform risk selection. Mm-hmm. And that's a very delicate balance in the wider construct of the market. And when you have this almost, again, normalization of cybersecurity insurance, that can remain a challenge to ensure that you collect all of the data points needed to make informed risk-based decisions.
Okay. I guess just kind of we've talked a lot about data, talked a lot about claims. What kind of, have you seen any interesting changes maybe over the last year or two in terms of frequency and severity of attacks?
We've certainly seen clients in general in the market up-level their defenses. There's certainly a trend to take advantage of the services, both pre-breach and post-breach, that are out there in the market to fortify and stabilize those insureds so they can continue to not only hone in on, but improve their risk postures moving forward.
Okay. So you've been analyzing some of this data as well then, just in terms of cyber claims data. What are some of the maybe common or interesting things that you've seen when you go back and you kind of analyze this info?
We as a market, you know, we've seen that the basics matter, right? Multi-factor authentication, it matters. So it's not certainly something that would sound earth-shattering or surprise anyone, but the message is the basics are making a difference.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Insurance is really interesting in the sense that it gives you such a lens into that, because I felt like before I went into insurance, I used to just be sometimes overwhelmed by this huge list of things that needed to get done. It's just like massive monster list. Like, okay, I got to do this. Oh, this is bad. This is bad. This is bad. Somebody could get me this way. And then you get to insurance claims data and you're like, okay, like these handful of things, get those first. As soon as you get those, then you can start to worry about the other million things. But it's, 85% the same problem, the same handful of things that cause all the claims. So, insurance, I think, has been really good about boiling it down to the, like you said, the basics. Okay. So let me shift a little bit. Underwriting management is a discipline. What are your thoughts on the future of it? And what concerns do you have? I want to hear both the sort of positive, fluffy thoughts, but also like, what are you worried about?
The exciting prospect about being in the underwriting management discipline in cybersecurity insurance is that if you've been doing this for a number of years, or even just started yesterday, there's always something new to contemplate, such that you have to examine, how are you supporting the business? How are you supporting your underwriters? How are you supporting data science and actuary to put forth not only products that our clients want to buy, but also service their needs? And with the evolution of now very meaningful data sets coming in, mm-hmm. and we're able to examine, what does good risk selection look like? How do we lean into data science tools to extract meaningful insights? And then again, make sure that that filters into the application questions that we thoughtfully ask our insureds to complete. That's a really exciting prospect, right? And it's certainly never a dull moment. And it's certainly ever evolving, right? Because this is, cyber insurance went from proactive, certainly, to reactive in the last 5 years, accelerated by the immense ransomware claims we saw. But that also gives us an opportunity to constantly up-level on, how does the application process, how do we also service customers in that same lens? How do we ensure that we're getting the data that we not only need for risk selection, but how do we turn that data into something meaningful to support them, not just at the renewal process, but also during the policy period? And how do we also ensure that we remain there for them through the policy life cycle? Again, not just at that point of renewal. Those are all incredibly exciting concepts that are obviously well underway in this market. And that, for me, is the next evolution of cyber insurance.
So it's sort of, using this underwriting, kind of feeding into the risk management, kind of engagement with clients kind of year round is maybe.
Right. So we've already seen tremendous movement toward that concept. So how do we continue to optimize it such that it is and remains meaningful for our insured? And how do we give them information that is actionable, right, against their risk profile, not just another data point for them to consider, if that makes sense? So when we talk to insureds, we as a market, we have the obligation and responsibility to ensure that it's a bilateral feedback, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not enough just to say, well, here's your risk profile, here's why it matters, here's how we're here to help, right? And how do those data points also filter back on a continuous cycle of ensuring that we're empowering them to constantly monitor their risk profile?
Yeah, I think it's, I've always been such a fan of that kind of, proactive engagement and the lens that insurance brings to it. I think the hard market gave us a great opportunity to do a lot more of that. How do you kind of see, like, it feels like things are starting to soften? Do you think we'll start losing progress on doing that?
It's a great question. I don't love the word soften.
Yeah.
Because it's suggesting that the market was too hard, right?
Yeah.
So we as an industry, we did what, frankly, we had to do, right? Because we had one set of pricing assumptions, and it turned out it wasn't enough, as we learned, right? Because loss ratios in the industry just skyrocketed. So we moved to where there was pricing sufficiency. And now, so rather than a softening, I would call it a leavening. We've had 24 months of really, it feels like an eternity, of really solid data that we can then examine in the rears of, what did this mean for our book composition? What did this mean for our loss ratio, right? Loss ratios as an industry. And so you can start to understand, okay, where is that point in space? And this is different for each insurance company, right? But just based upon the individual risks that they have in their portfolio and their portfolio composition, any portfolio would be going through this same evolution, and it's bespoke and individual to each different insurance company. But we were given that opportunity, and now we're enough in the rear such that it's not a softening per se, such that it's almost a leveling off, perhaps a softening in that exhaustion element of cybersecurity importance, right? Like everyone knows it's important, but does it continually get the attention it needs to stay ahead of those threat factors that are ever, you know?
Yeah, I think
violating our insureds.
There's a few directions maybe to kind of take that discussion. I do worry that, you know, people do forget. You know, they kind of they get a little complacent. It's like, okay, we've gotten used to this level of risk. We're going to kind of sort of ignore it because it's the baseline level of risk. Like that's the new baseline. It's, I think, just humans and risk. Like if it's a new risk or if it's an increased risk, we're really good at recognizing that. When it's kind of the same high risk, we kind of go, and you just kind of get a little what's the word I'm looking for? Like casual about it, or like you don't worry about it so much.
That's just it. And that's where it's, for me, very important as insurance carriers to ensure that we're communicating in meaningful and digestible ways.
Yeah.
That makes the feedback loop as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
For insureds to really tackle what are the KPIs that inform not only good risk selection, but then also keep infrastructures as secure as possible.
Yeah. It's really precise, I think is probably the word I'd use. Efficient as well, but also very precise. And hopefully the insureds won't just view it as, well, you know, the prices aren't skyrocketing anymore. It's kind of gone. It's even now. It seems like it's leveled out. You know, we can get the cover that we want. Okay, yeah, this is less of a problem. Hopefully they take it as saying, okay, these insurers are really on top of this, and they're really giving us very pointed feedback on what we need to worry about. We'll see, I guess. Okay, let me switch topics. Just kind of looking at, you know, I like to ask people about things in the news, cyber stuff in the news. What do you find really interesting going on right now in the world?
From an insurance perspective, it's what I constantly think about is, you know, everything we've talked about to present, which is data, actuarial assumptions, right? But then also, does past risk inform future risk, right? And future loss. And so I know that that's something that is very topical in a couple of lines of insurance, namely cyber and property. The fascinating piece for me is just that comparison between cyber and property, rightly or wrongly, right? But it really, I'm indifferent to it, such that there's a lot of lessons to be learned from property that can be translated into cyber. It's also fascinating to see the cyber insurance and reinsurance and ILS market expand, right? Because we know that this is a rapidly growing industry, whereas there is more need to meet customers' needs from a capacity perspective. And it's very intriguing to see where those markets go.
You've mentioned property a few times. What are some of the specific lessons that cyber needs to be learning from property?
Sure. Property, right? Put a box around it and said, these are the things we need for good risk selection, right? One of the first markets to do it, right? We need certain building codes to ensure XYZ. That really, right? While we don't have any, you know, central governing body per se, there's a lot of patterns such that the same, you know, five questions are asked by the same 25 insurance companies, right? Or the same 50 insurance companies. And so we're getting to a place of that normalization of kind of table stakes, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a decent comparison. We also see the ILS markets, right? With that heightened interest in taking cyber risk even beyond the reinsurance market into some other forms of alternative capital. That's also a really exciting prospect and synonymous with property insurance.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's, it's been an interesting trend. You know, I always have struggled to keep as much of an eye on kind of the financial engineering side. Over time, I've gotten better and better and more knowledgeable about it, but obviously I came from sort of maybe the incident response claim side. Like I kind of get that. And then we start getting into, well, how do you pay for this? How does capital work in the insurance market? And I think it's just interesting in the sense that it allows us to expand the cyber insurance market, you know, by getting new sources of capital.
You know, there were a lot of key retail events that happened in 2013. If you really just sit down and think about where we were then, that was only 10 years ago, right? I mean, that's fairly scant on the scale of maturation of a market. Mm-hmm. So in a mere 10 years, the size, the scope, the scale, the maturation, the services connected to this product, the entire infrastructure, whether it be financial / reinsurance or cyber services and associated services to those policies, it's fascinating to think how far we've come.
Yeah. It is, certainly the period. Well, yeah, it's just kind of interesting the different shifts that have happened, I guess, when I look back over the last 10 years. Obviously had lots of product maturation. Obviously Beazley was quite early on the services, but I think started to see a lot of insurers get much more aggressive on services. More technical development in terms of just technical skill across the board, you know, whether it's in underwriting or in claims. It is almost a completely different universe than it was 10 years ago. Certainly.
It truly is. Way. You just sit back and take a moment to contemplate what we were doing as an industry 10 years ago and what we're doing now. And just imagine where we'll be 10 years from now.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It is fun to look back, and I look back and I think about what, 'cause 10 years is about the amount of time I've been working in sort of insurance or insurance related stuff. And it's like, yeah, geez, that was only 10 years ago. And it was like a different universe. I mean, especially in this part of the world, but I think in the US too.
Yeah. It's been, you know, they say in life, timing is everything. And it's been truly a distinct pleasure to, it's kind of like almost those who were in this early.
Yeah.
Really saw the evolution of this space, but lived it.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not often we go back and think about how far we've come to also like the opportunity ahead of us as an industry.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, so I guess just back to some of what we were talking about, you know, being able to look over this data, being able to understand, you know, what we need to do to kind of improve loss ratios. What would you say from your perspective makes the biggest difference?
The tools available to not only portfolio managers, but data scientists are only just rapidly evolving to continue to isolate and extract those key metrics that are showing patterns of informed risk selection. That for me has been the has been and will be the biggest demonstrable shift, simply because the technology is coming towards us, right? To have those kinds of insights.
Can you give me some examples? Like what kinds of tools? What do you use?
At a very, very high level, you get into things like machine learning, right? Yeah. And being able to extract wider data sets and pull out what might have been the most meaningful point of information against the claims information you've got.
Yeah. No, I just you got me thinking when we were back to talking about applications and the questions and whatnot. I guess, you know, it is a common topic, but I thought I'd ask you anyway. It's like, because everybody talks about it. It's sort of the scanning question, the outside in scanning, the inside out scanning, what good is scanning? Does it actually help?
And then sitting that on top of what does it all mean? Right.
Yeah.
And so that's obviously a balance, right? Because this technology, it's not just about the output. It's about layering the output with logic and good old underwriting acumen, right? And things like Enid, right? So events not in data, but things we know, right, as underwriters, and things that underwriters see and hear, that matters too, right?
Yeah.
That's the essence of portfolio management. It's not just one lens. It's many different inputs to arrive at a cohesive picture.
Okay. Yeah, that's that makes a lot of sense. It's sort of the, you know, what are you doing with all this data that you have, and then maybe some outside stuff as well. Okay. Well, I'd like to ask a few more questions, just maybe more around your background and some of your thoughts. So the first one is, and this is always one of my favorite questions. I love the answers to this. How did you originally get into the insurance industry? How did you end up here?
This is a very little known story. But I started off as a chemical engineering major in college. And it was fascinating, but I learned after the first semester that it was not for me. And so I decided to focus on computer science instead, and specifically management information systems, and then as a secondary marketing. So I took all of the normal courses, including economics, management information systems was my minor. And I found that I really appreciated order and reasoning. And I had an economics professor come up to me and say, Megan, you should consider underwriting. You seem to have a knack for understanding trends and patterns and why things are the way they are. And I asked him, undertaking? I have no idea what you're talking about. But he said, you should go to the Career Center and you should ask them about insurance companies coming to campus and specifically for underwriting jobs. And sure enough, Chubb Insurance was on campus the following week. And that is how I ended up not only in the insurance industry, but also at my time at Chubb Insurance, they had a teeny tiny product called Safety Net, right? Because I was in the executive protection division. And I went to a couple of folks that I considered mentors. And I said, hey, this, like, right, I studied management information systems. This makes sense to me. And next thing I knew, I was in the professional lines division, which at the time was the only group looking at those whole, like, you know, failure of computer systems via the MPL, or they had, you know, computer system endorsements in order to write cyber insurance, which was just really exciting and new. You had to go to the financial institutions department and they didn't have an opening. And so I just studied cyber in professional lines. And then transitioned to a market where I could do it full time. And that is how I ended up in not only insurance, but cyber insurance.
That's a super sensible way to get in. I did not know you were in chemical engineering. I think I fought all the way through my undergrad and then switched to MIS after the undergraduate. And it's like, that was just pure stubbornness. I think I had to graduate, but engineering definitely gave
MIS was far more sensible, right? and chemical engineering.
So I wasn't a chemi, but probably first year chemi classes are probably pretty similar to the mechanical stuff I was doing in aerospace. It was just, yeah, I think when I took MIS was like, oh, this is stuff I can actually understand what the professor is talking about without needing to go read a long time.
Yeah, it was very, I remember it was very sensible. It was just how things communicated in the piping behind it, right? And at the time it was database infrastructure, right? Like on Excel sheets and some very basic computer coding language, but it was sensible. And I appreciated the order of X equals Y. And if you have you know, one tiny element of your code, remember writing code. And if you had a tiny element of your code off, like your website didn't work and you had to learn to be very precise.
That's true. I remember all that. Although, you know, because I didn't do it until master's, it was, you know, it was a bit later. I guess things were pretty complicated by the time I took my master's. The undergraduate, the technology I used as an undergrad was in engineering was very different. It was very like, it's funny now when I talk to people, even old people, and they tell me about their sort of early experiences. And I'm like, that's early? I'm like, I'm like, I remember when the internet came out, I was super excited when the web showed up. I was like, well, this is cool. There's pictures on the web. I mean, obviously there was internet before, but I still remember when the web came out. I still remember my thought when I first saw the first web browser that was like graphical that you could install on your computer, not the one sort of being used behind, you know, in CERN or whatever. But it's like, oh, that's super cool. There's pictures on there. But it's fun thinking back to that. But it is super cool that you went from engineering into MIS into insurance. I can relate to that.
And it was all thanks to economics. I ended up in insurance. It wasn't because of the MIS. It was one professor who was like, you should look at this. And I quite literally had no idea what he was talking about. I remember going home to my roommates and asking them if anyone knew what underwriting was.
It's funny. It's not that dissimilar to some people, but I like the economics, the MIS, that all kind of ties together. So next question then, what would you recommend to anyone who wants to have a successful career in insurance?
Just be hungry. I remember those earliest days. I read and still do, just read as much as you can get your hands on. I'll call out Judy Selby, right? Yeah. She was, gosh, I would just devour her content. I remember I was an underwriter, gosh, in maybe my third, fourth year, and I would print out articles and I would take them home with me on the weekend and I would read them and read about the earliest case law. Be interested, because anything that truly sparks your interest, coupled with that energy and desire to always improve, right? You got to have fun doing it, right? And just make sure it's something that you really want to latch onto and then dive in headfirst.
Yeah. It's, I hate to sort of follow your passion, but I think certainly follow things that you think are interesting, something that you're not going to have a problem being so intense about and being so into, that you can get to a level of expertise. Because if you really dislike it, it's going to be super hard to be good at it.
It would be hard to do it if you just disliked it. And I just remember, you know, even underwriting, I would just devour individual risks and really get the core of what they did and what made them tick. And that was also something that, you know, risk managers and brokers also really appreciate. My other piece of advice has, you know, and that's applicable to anyone in any industry, just do as you say and say as you do, right? Yeah. Especially early in your career, you've got to really, you know, trust is earned. You have to do as you say and say as you do, particularly with the brokerage community, right? Because they're the ones who are thoughtful to bring individual underwriters business, and they need to have that trust in partnership that you're going to execute to the best of your ability on behalf of their client.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, thanks for that. I, just in terms of, you know, next podcast guest, is there anyone you'd like to throw under the bus
I don't know if Judy has been on, but has Judy Selby been on?
He has not. And a few people have asked, and I swore I asked her, but I can't remember. So this is really funny, actually, just in terms of guest selection. I have the worst time because I forget who I've asked. I forget who I haven't asked. And then it's like, people come up to me and be like, why haven't you asked me to be on the show? And I'm like, because I literally just didn't remember who I've asked and who I haven't asked. So it's just... there's such a randomness to this. I walk up and I'm like, oh, that was a really interesting talk. Do you want to be on the show? Or, you know, somebody will recommend someone else, or I just think, oh, somebody I know that'd be cool to have on. Yeah. So I thought I had asked Judy, but I might not have. And if she is listening to this all the way to the end, she'll be like, no, you didn't send me a message. I think she would be an ideal guest. So she's definitely on my radar if I haven't asked her already.
She was a very early pioneer. And I know for me personally, a lot of the content she was publishing in those very early days was the North Star, right? When not a lot of people were talking. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. And it's funny how different my approach to a lot of stuff was just by virtue, obviously American, you know, but having been here so many years and working here so many years, I got into the market from a European perspective, from a pre-GDPR. You know, nobody's getting sued anywhere.
Very different. Yes.
And then there's the communities, which I think have become more international over time. But I used to feel pretty separated out here with the little group of people that were doing cyber in Europe. And it's interesting. I'm always learning new stuff from before I started being connected back to the US. So thanks a lot for that. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Megan. It was great. Great getting to chat with you. And I really had a lot of fun putting this together.
Thanks for having me. It's a sincere pleasure and honor to join you.
If you want to learn more about our host, Anthony, or his company, Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.